Small capsule of Monitor Music rots here, Out of Space by Billy Preston. The game. Jim Lowe with you, and this is the Something Old portion of Monitor. We're going to be traveling down memory lane, memories, memories, to the land of nostalgia with a famous designer who reminisces about a green feather dress he created a decade ago. We're also going to visit the musical past with this oldie. Actually, this was released only 2 or 3 months ago, but the way things are in the record business today, it qualifies as a blast from the ancient past. Tommy James and Cat's Eye in the Window.
Well, the glass was all busted, but my God, the thing must have won.
Ever wonder why dress designers charge so much for their creations? That has crossed your mind, huh? Ever wonder how come ladies often show up wearing the same original creation? Well, for the answers to these and other suspenseful questions, here's Cindy Adams and her guest, designer Arnold Scozzi.
Arnold, who do you dress amongst the people in the world that we know? Who are some of the names who you dress?
Well, through the years, you know, I've dressed women from social levels and women in the theater, in the movies.
Drop me a couple of names.
Okay. Well, I've dressed Christina Ford, and Barbara Streisand is someone who I've dressed for about 8 years.
Oh, did you do that jazzy number, that gorgeous, fantastic thing that got all the publicity, the Academy Awards? Did
yes.
you do that one?
Yes, the Academy, the one she wore to the Academy Awards.
Yeah, describe that one again for me.
Well,
it got an awful lot of publicity.
Yeah, it was very strange because it didn't come off as it did live through the papers, because it was a black net jumpsuit that was not by any means transparent, and it was covered in clear sequins so that it just shimmered, and it had a white collar and cuffs and a bow. And until that moment, Barbara had never been portrayed in modern clothes, and nobody knew her out of a costume, you know, a period costume. And so I wanted very much to show the world what she really looked like. She has a terrific figure, and she's a wonderful-looking girl, and she's a very contemporary-looking girl.
A Barbara Streisand, with all her money, does she pay a regular price, or does she get a discount?
No one gets a discount.
Why not? Your prices are not to be believed, my dear. What is so
great
about an Arnold Scozzi that you should charge the kind of prices that you charge, my boy?
The one thing you get in a made-to-order dress is that, first of all, it's fitted to you. It's chosen for you. If the proportion is wrong, the proportion is fixed for you and to make you look better. And that never seems to go out of style. It's a dress that you can wear for years. You can put it away usually for 3 or 4 years. And take it out again, and suddenly it's a whole new dress. You get much better value out of a dress that's made to order for you than you do out of one you just buy off the rack.
Yeah, but you're talking about much better value of $1,500 of the prices that you're murmuring about.
But you find out that if you wear a dress for 7 years, you're really paying $200 a year for it.
Oh,
it's
such a steal. I hadn't thought of it
that
way.
Yeah, no, but it's absolutely true. And not only that, but you're usually more comfortable in that dress, and you feel better, and you usually look better in it.
Yeah, well, anybody
looks
better.
It's like a man who has a made-to-order suit made, as opposed to one who picks one off the rack.
Well, why couldn't you make it for a little less than $1,500?
It isn't $1,500. I don't know where you got that price from, but anyway. An evening dress is from about $10.50 up, depending on the dress. I mean, a simple evening dress, a plain evening dress that's beautifully cut and beautifully made, and that can go through, you know, 50 cleanings, and each time come out looking like it did the first day it was made for you. That's a quality dress.
That's $10.50. Supposing
that's
we wanted to lay with sequins and bugle beads and flowers and rosettes.
It gets more, but it gets more in ready-to-wear, too.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you can buy ready-to-wear of different designers today that is not made for you and is not fitted to you and cannot be refitted in a shop. and it can run anywhere up to $2,500, $3,000 if it's a beaded dress.
How long can someone wear a dress? I have one Balmain that is literally 20 years old. It's
sure.
a classic, and I still wear it.
See? So you just proved my point.
Yes, I know. I'm joking with you, but of course, how old are some Skazis that are still being dragged out?
Well, I haven't been in business 20 years, but I mean, I've been working for about 14 years. And at the Feather Ball, a dress appeared that I had done about 13 years ago. It was a green feather dress in bands of feathers that was shaded from very pale to very dark green. It was a sensational dress, strapless, a little bit above the floor, almost ankle length, with a very wide belt. And it was worn originally with a white coat that was all lined in feathers. It was the first extraordinary feather dress that appeared probably in the last two decades. And it caused a great sensation. And I remember it was worn by some very exciting people. As a matter of fact, Lauren Bacall wore it in a play that I did the clothes for her for. And Dorothy Kilgallen wore it to Princess Margaret's wedding. And we sold at about $2,000 retail when we were doing then ready to wear clothes. We sold about 20 of those dresses throughout the country.
You mean if somebody's buying a $2,000 dress, there are going to be 20 ladies sashaying around in it?
Yes, there might very well be. In fact, when I did clothes for Mrs. Eisenhower at one point, a woman arrived from California at the White House to a ball and turned up in a dress in, thank God, another color, but the same print, the same cut velvet, and the same dress as Mrs. Eisenhower came down the stairs in. My point is that a dress, that green feather dress, looked absolutely sensational in 1971 as much as it did 13 years earlier.
That was designer Arnold Skazi with the green feathers and our monitor bird, Cindy Adams, here on the Monitor Beacon. Jim Nero again, and I brought new monitor music with me. Sheila Ray's Thanks for the Lesson. You're welcome.
You were the one who told me that I had the qualities that made you dig the way I looked at you, to tell you things were fine. Now you've gone and left me here without a goodbye warning. Decided to be mine.
Well, you've heard about love and marriage. How about love and boredom? The same thing, you say? Well, let's find out what our resident psychologist, Dr. Joyce Brothers, has to say.
A man writes, "Dear Dr. Brothers, I've been a hard worker and a big earner all my life, and I'm now 42. I've had time for little but study and business until last year when I fell in love, really for the first time in my life. My mother is very much opposed to my marrying this woman, and even more opposed to my plan to take a year off and travel with her. I can't feel guilty about my mother, as she is in good health, and I've given her all the physical comforts she could possibly need. I've not married because I felt I owed her this, but I don't want to lose this woman. If I do, I think I'll simply die of boredom. By all means, get married, whether your mother likes it or not. You're a grown man, and you can't allow yourself to be dominated by her feelings anymore. In time, she may adjust and see that her attitude is probably the result of her own possessive feelings about a son she wants to hang on to at all costs. The odds seem to be stacked against people living alone without a mate. People living alone are ill more often than those who live with others, according to a study by the American Medical Association. Life insurance records show that couples who are happily in love and remain in that state average appreciably longer lifespans than those who are either divorced, separated, or remain single. Studies show that in spite of all the complaints, married people are generally much happier than single people, and this is especially true of married males. American husbands are more satisfied with their marriages than their wives are. In fact, a University of Michigan Institute for Social Research survey showed that 58% of the men were completely satisfied with their marriages, compared to 53% of the wives. Incidentally, that same survey indicated that men were not so enthusiastic about their jobs. If you've been working at a demanding job, you probably need a vacation, and if you can afford it, it might well improve both your physical and your mental health. Psychologist Dr. Thomas Meyer, who has studied the effect of monotony on people's working lives, feels that boredom can lead to emotional and mental illness. The drive for job success in America traps people in a monotonous treadmill that can have severe side effects. The more intelligent a person is, he notes, the less able he is to cope with boredom in his life. Love is probably one of the best solutions for boredom, for it provides new interests and heightened awareness. It can really sharpen all of one's senses and give an individual more insight into himself as well as others. It also helps provide the necessary change that is needed to shake off boredom. For those who are less lucky than you, simple changes can often relieve boredom too, such as taking a different route to work or deliberately trying new foods or new styles of clothes. This is Dr. Joyce Brothers for Monitor.
Joyce, you know, I have a feeling that any day now you'll be getting a letter from that man's new wife about her mother-in-law. Dennis Coffey, Ride Sally Ride. Speaking of riding reminds me of the two New Yorkers who were taking a taxi home from California. Before they got in, one fellow said to his companion, "You get in first, Joe, I get out at 125th Street. I'm Jim Lowe, and we have to get right out here ourselves so your local station can identify itself. But we'll be back, so you fasten your seatbelt and stay right with us, right here."
Second Sunday in Zion, just a urban spot. The world between city and suburb. Industrial work and racism in the south. On Second Sunday today on NBC Radio.
If you can't afford college, you'll never get a good job.
Wrong. Today, there is a crying need for technicians. And you don't need 4 years of college to become a well-paid technician. All you need is a year or two of technical training. For information, write Careers, Washington, D.C. That's Careers, Washington, D.C.
If you're going to break another heart, then Neo Morricone breaks in with The Burglars.
Thank you. NBC, welcomes the pleasure of your company.
Jim Lowe and Monitor it is. And if you've been keeping up with the news, as I know you have, you know that a couple of prominent Americans have been stirring up controversy on account of their visits to North Vietnam. Some congressmen want to try actress Jane Fonda for treason. And just yesterday, Secretary of State Rogers blasted former Attorney General Ramsey Clark for his Radio Hanoi broadcast. But there are two other Americans who have not only visited Hanoi, but have given valuable equipment to the North Vietnamese with the full knowledge and consent of our government. We have a report on that coming up right after music by Three Dog Night, Black and White. This year, a special shipment of equipment used in heart surgery was delivered to Hanoi by two Americans who represented the American Friends Service Committee. That's a Quaker organization which gives aid to civilians on both sides of conflicts. One of the men who made that trip was Dr. George Pereira, former associate dean and professor of medicine at Columbia University College of Physicians and Surgeons. Next on Monitor, Dr. Pereira discusses his humanitarian visit to North Vietnam with Mike Moss, NBC News.
Dr. Pereira, you just came back from North Vietnam. I thought North Vietnam was off limits for Americans.
I suppose it is for many, but we were there on a mission and with the knowledge of the State Department, and our passports were validated.
Does this mean that the State Department recognizes that the American Friends Service Committee helps both sides?
I assume they do, but this is what our function was.
A tacit recognition, in other words, rather than an overt recognition.
Yes.
Did you speak the Vietnamese language, or did you need an interpreter?
No, neither of us spoke Vietnamese. We managed in English or French or used interpreters.
French is mainly the common language over there, isn't it? Or the common second language?
A little more common, but I would imagine spoken only by the elderly. For example, I gave a medical lecture to many of the leading physicians of Hanoi using two interpreters, one who knew scientific terms and the other one who knew English.
What was the reason for your trip? Why did you go?
The primary purpose was to bring in some 400 pounds, almost $14,000 worth of heart and lung equipment for civilian use for a hospital in Hanoi.
The North Vietnamese hospitals do not have this kind of equipment?
Very little of it.
What did you see in North Vietnam?
We had a busy time. We saw many officials, newspaper people, many committee heads. We visited dikes, hospitals, schools, residences that had been bombed. We took a trip south on Route 1 about 50 miles to see the bombings and a dike at the city of Nam Dinh.
You mean the dikes have been bombed?
Can't speak for more than what we saw. We saw a dike, and that dike had received damage, now being repaired to one of the primary dikes. And then there were two bomb craters in secondary dikes. These had been bombed within a month of the time we were there.
Now, these are dikes that are used to keep the sea out of the agricultural fields?
In this case, the river. There's a big difference in the high and low water marks. And during the rainy season, floods come sometimes spontaneously. And of course, if dikes are damaged, there is the possibility of major flooding and all the consequences thereof during the rainy season, which comes this month and next month.
Were the craters that you saw in this dike large enough that it would be difficult to repair them?
No, I couldn't say that. I should think that with enough man and woman power, they could be repaired.
In a short period of time or over an extended period of time?
I think this is possible. More difficult to judge would be possible damage, cracks, fissures, and so on beneath the surface that might not be visible for repair.
Is there a way to tell who bombed the dike?
I wasn't there at the time, but we talked to one French journalist, for example, who had witnessed a dike bombing by American planes.
There's also been an accusation made by North Vietnamese broadcasts that American planes have bombed hospitals and other civilian targets in North Vietnam.
I can only tell you what we saw. We saw bombed hospitals. We saw bombed schools. We saw bombed residences, workers' apartments, homes, houses, and such bombings have taken place. Again, all of the ones that we saw were within the last month.
Dr. Pereira, how about the victims? Whenever a bomb falls, somebody gets hurt.
Can't tell you that. The North Vietnamese played down their casualties, one might guess for morale reasons. We did hear some of their figures. For example, at one series of apartment houses that we saw, it was said that there were 20 or 30 killed and many wounded.
Did you, as a doctor, visit any hospitals in which you treated or observed patients being treated who were victims of bombings?
At the St. Paul Hospital in Hanoi, we were shown more than a dozen kids who had been hurt by anti-personnel bombs.
These are the bombs with little bits of shrapnel.
Little bits of shrapnel, small darts of metal, other assorted and unpleasant things. And some of these children had been killed. We saw autopsies. Others badly wounded, and we saw them postoperatively. Some will have permanent defects, neurological and otherwise, as a result of the damage they received.
Dr. Pereira, the American government has said that some dikes have been damaged in North Vietnam by American bombings, but that the damage was done in connection with legitimate, as the State Department calls them, bombing raids on military targets. Did you, in your visit to North Vietnam, notice any military targets near dikes?
We didn't notice any, but there were, in some instances, roads nearby. It's perfectly possible that what looked like an innocent building to us might not have been at the time. It's possible that there were things on the roads at the time of a bombing that were weaponry. We can't say whether these bombings were intentional or accidental.
Do they build roads over dikes? Do they use the dikes as bases for roads?
I hear they do. The one we saw had a road maybe 300 or 400 feet away, but it was not a road on top of the dike.
How many dikes are there? I don't know much about the geography or the topography of North Vietnam. Are there a lot of dikes?
I've heard the figures. I don't know. But a lot of North Vietnam has large rivers which flow to the sea, and the country, which is largely an agrarian agricultural country, depends on the irrigation from these dikes, dike systems, to support its growth of rice and so on.
Gentlemen, sorry to interrupt, but we have to take care of some network business. Our guests, Dr. George Pereira and Mike Moss, will continue their interesting conversation in just a few minutes here on the Monitor Beacon. Jim Lowe and Monitor once again, and once again, Mike Moss, NBC News, and his guest, Dr. George Pereira, who recently visited North Vietnam in order to deliver surgical equipment from the Quaker organization called the American Friends Service Committee.
Dr. Pereira, let me get to something else that's been on my mind. What is Hanoi like? American planes have been there, have been bombing Hanoi and the environs. What's the city like?
It's a very attractive city. About 50% of its population has been evacuated. The center of it is in French colonial style, the periphery comparable to any Asiatic town. The people have a remarkable morale. They smile, they laugh with you and at you. They're working people. There still are women and children in the city. That's the picture that it presents.
Did you see evidences in Hanoi of bombing attacks?
Yes, we did. And the week we were there, there were 44 air raid alerts. There was one hairy experience when we were caught on a ferry, and it took us 5 or so minutes to get to a shelter. During that period, there were 16 fathoms almost directly overhead, anti-aircraft fire bursting around them, and an unpleasant experience to be under one's own planes.
Dr. Pereira, you were there as a visitor. How did you feel?
At times scared, very frequently interested in what was going on, doing our best not only in terms of bringing the civilian medical supplies, but also to learn as much as we could about the scene and the reactions of North Vietnam and its people.
Does the American Friends Service Committee take a political stance on actions that are taken against North Vietnam?
As individuals, many members probably do, but the Service Committee is really the action arm of the Society of Friends, or Quakers, trying to translate its beliefs into practice.
So you were there representing the service, the Friends Service Committee, and not as an individual interested in coming up with a political conclusion.
That is right.
What do you think, personally, of people like Jane Fonda and Ramsey Clark, who have visited North Vietnam and have made statements on North Vietnamese radio?
I can't speak about others and their motives or their reactions. I can only say that I think if one dispenses with hearsay evidence and tells the story as one really sees it on the basis of facts, these are things that I think should be told, that our public should know about, and one should not go beyond the evidence one has at hand.
Do you feel that the people of North Vietnam that you met in your visit in Hanoi and its environs are people who have a will to continue to just keep right on going in spite of whatever happens?
I can only tell you how they look and say. They are told and they appear to believe that they have already been at war for 20 or 30 years, that they have nothing else to lose, that it doesn't matter which presidential candidate is elected, that they can go on for at least another 4 years. They appear to be in reasonably good condition. They are certainly smiling and likable people, the ones we met. And that's the picture we received.
Dr. Pereira, did you notice in your visit in Hanoi any shortages of food or other essential supplies that might have been caused by the United States blockade of the harbor?
I can't answer how or why. I can only say that there were some places, some stores, in front of which were queues. There was talk of some shortages, some in food and some in other products. Whether this was the result of the blockade or years and years of being at war with one country or another, I can't say.
How did the countryside look? Did it look like it had been just devastated, or did it look like any typical low-lying farmland might look?
Didn't see that much of it. What we saw looked remarkably normal. Granted, there were, along elevations between fields, many of these small garbage pail-shaped bomb shelters, but in terms of the people at work, working in the rice paddies, carrying things with bamboo poles on their back, going around with carts pulled by oxen, picture very normal, I would imagine.
It didn't look to you like you might imagine a country at war would look?
Not from many scenes. On the other hand, we passed through one town which had been almost completely demolished. We saw, both in Hanoi and in Nam Dinh, a great deal of damage, and this to me looked like the results of war as one might see it in any country.
This damage that's been done, did it appear to be damage that would have caused great civilian casualties?
Hard to say. For example, on hearsay, one gathers that there were many civilian casualties in Haiphong. When we talked to various men, women, children in Hanoi, many of them had lost a brother, a father, an aunt or uncle, a grandfather, as a result of war, so undoubtedly there's been some civilian damage.
Dr. Pereira, thank you very much.
You're welcome, Mike.
This is Mike Moss, NBC News, reporting for Monitor.
Ever heard of the suburban sprawl? No, Virginia, it's not a new dance. It's what's happening to our cities and changing our lives. Tonight, immediately following this segment of Monitor, NBC Radio's Peabody Award-winning Second Sunday series will examine life in the suburbs. Participating in the program will be George Romney, Secretary of Housing and Urban Development, and the mayors of such cities as New Orleans, Baltimore, Cleveland, Indianapolis, and many more. So do stay around for the Suburban Sprawl on Second Sunday, immediately following the Monitor News on the Hour. Kiola and the French Connection. Speaking of which, a French lady was connecting with a tennis ball out in Madison, Wisconsin the other day, knows how we get into this, and causing a massive traffic jam at the same time. It seems she was playing tennis topless. That's a new kind of double fault, huh? Before they drop the net on us, we're going to go quietly to the Monitor newsroom. So do stay tuned for the news, and then Second Sunday. Till next time, Jim Lowe says, straight ahead.
When your baby's sick, you take his temperature and call the doctor, right? Well, unfortunately, not everyone can. In many areas throughout the world, there are no doctors to call. But there is hope. Project Hope. It began with the ship, the SS Hope, a floating hospital which has traveled the world over. It's staffed with doctors, nurses, and technologists who not only treat patients, but train medical personnel in the developing countries they visit. The Hope mission lasts 10 months. But when the ship departs, medical teams remain behind to continue the teaching programs. This gives others an opportunity to learn, and they learn in their own environment, working with their own people. Project Hope also has medical training programs here in the United States for American Indians and Mexican Americans. Help, hope, help others. Send a contribution to Project Hope, Room A, Washington, D.C.